filing of records and preservation of medical records. There are two common methods of numbering and filing records. One is the assignment of a new register number to each patient at the time of admission. So, you know, typically every patient at the time of admission, a separate file is made. This is known as a serial numbering, and the chart may be filed either separately or under numbers as assigned together under the most recent number. The latter is modified or a brought forward serial system. The second method, known as the unit numbering, is the assignment of one number to a patient on first admission and using the same number of subsequent admissions. So these are the two common methods. Before a unit record system is installed, careful study should be made of what are the percentage of readmissions, activity of records, that is how often and over how long a period the records are used or drawn from the files, average size of the charts, and location of the master name file for quick reference to previous admissions. So how long to preserve this record? This is again a very important question. Limitation period for filing a case is maximum up to 3 years under the Limitation Act. 2 years according to the CPA Act. So the Consumer Protection Act says, you know, within 2 years of the patient undergoing treatment, they can ask for the records and file the case. But as per the Limitation Act, it goes to 3 years. However, this limitation period starts only after the patient comes to know the effect of the alleged negligence on the part of the doctor. So this is again a very tricky situation. So say the patient comes to know after a period of time, then this date would start only after the patient comes to know of the effect. Maharashtra government has issued a resolution which states that the OPD paper should be kept for 3 years, indoor for 5 years, and papers of medical legal case for 30 years. So for the hospital, it goes without saying, okay, even if it is about 3 years, say it's an OPD patient, you have to maintain those papers for life, because you never know, you know, if not in the physical form, if not the hard copy, at least the computer records have to be there available. If it's an indoor patient, it should be kept for 5 years, and for medical legal cases, 30 years. Because we all know how the judiciary works, and it takes time sometimes, you know, so it can go on, the case can go on for 10 years, 15 years. So it is necessary to maintain all these records. So ideally, the hospital, even if it's say the OPD cases beyond 3 years also, I would always say you have to maintain the records, keep it in the computerized form, and you never know when you require it. Dying declaration is provided by section 32, subsection 1 of the Indian Evidence Act. According to this section, dying declaration is the declaration of a dying person as to the cause of his death or as to the circumstances of the transaction which resulted in his death when the cause of the death is in question. So when the person is dying, he makes a declaration as to the cause of this death and the circumstances which resulted in the same. If the declarant survives after making the dying declaration, the statement is inadmissible. So if the patient survives after making this declaration, then the statement is of not admissible, but the statement can be used under section 148 of the Indian Evidence Act in order to contradict, corroborate, impeach or confirm the credit of the person by whom it was made. So in certain cases, yes, it can be used. Admissibility of dying declaration. Section 60 of the Indian Evidence Act says that oral evidence must be direct, and the rule of the law is that hearsay evidence which is not direct is not admissible. So oral evidence has to be direct. If it is hearsay, it is not admissible. Dying declaration is a kind of hearsay evidence, but is admissible as an exception to the general rule that hearsay evidence is not admissible. So the only case of dying declaration is a kind of hearsay evidence that can be made admissible as an exception to the general rule. Medical negligence is also known as professional misconduct, or also be called as malpractice. Medical negligence, most cases lie within the civil law, and cases where, you know, negligence has been so gross that they could be called a criminal offense is very rare to find, because though doctor or hospital would do something, that it should be called as a criminal offense. Law of torts, negligence, medical or otherwise, is a civil wrong known as tort, where a person fails to take proper care so that the damage results. For negligence of any kind to be proved, it must be shown that all the following four components exist. So it's also known as the tort, where a person fails to take proper care, you know, so that's called negligence. If it happens during the course of the treatment where it was informed to the patient, fine, but say if the doctor is not equipped or the institution is not equipped to do a particular procedure and they are doing it, then that's called negligence, right? So what are the following components that the defendant doctor owed a duty of care to the patient, that the defendant was in breach of that duty, that the plaintiff suffered damage, that the patient suffered damage, and the damage was caused by the breach of duty of care. So in case of the following of components exist in the law of tort, the duty of care, the doctor must possess a reasonable degree of proficiency. We have discussed this. A person, say from the alternative system, if he is trying to do an operation, not allowed, not permissible, so he must have that proficiency, he must have the skills required to do a particular procedure. No doctor can be expected to be aware of all the current medical knowledge nor be able to apply known diagnostic and therapeutic techniques. So doctor is not God, let us understand that, but he has certain skills, he has certain knowledge which can help him to cure a patient. But we cannot expect a doctor to be aware of all the medical knowledge or to know all the therapeutic and diagnostic techniques. But for whatever he specializes in, he has to have complete knowledge of that, right? A house surgeon is not expected to possess the same skills as the consultant surgeon, but at the same time, he is expected to confine his activities to a level of medical care which is within his competency. As I said, you know, the attending doctor might not be a surgeon. So it is always better in such cases to refer the case to a surgeon who is competent enough to handle that case. But if it's an emergency, then he is not expected to wait for suppose the surgeon is going to take around 2 hours to come to the hospital. So some degree of care has to be given to the patient so that, you know, no further damage occurs. So at that time, in case of emergencies, yes, he is supposed to give the treatment that is required. But otherwise, it's always better to refer such cases to a specialist. When a senior doctor delegates a task to a junior, he must assure himself that his assistant is sufficient, competent and experienced to do the job. So, you know, many times doctors give their cases to their juniors, but this can only happen if they have trained their juniors well enough, if they are sure that they are going to take reasonably good care of the patient and they are competent to do the job. The negligence can only occur when the doctor-patient relationship is established. Very important. Offer his services in an emergency to a patient who is not already his patient, has no doctor-patient relation exists, though the ethics are questionable. So, you know, there is a very fine line between what to do, what not to do, ethics. So, for a doctor, the most important thing is the doctor-patient relationship has to be established. But, say, the patient is not known to the doctor and if there is an emergency, then he has to act, you know. But in such cases, from the doctor's side also, there is a dilemma whether to do the patient or not to do the patient. But yes, ethics says it is whenever there is an emergency, a doctor has to respond to it. Breach of duty to exercise reasonable skill and care. A doctor breaches his duty when he fails to reach the standard of proficiency expected of him. The breach may be of one of commission or omission, that is either doing something wrong or failing to do something right. So, a doctor is at fault, you know, when he fails to reach the standard of proficiency that is expected of him. So, he has to possess the required skills and knowledge. Say he is a surgeon, so he should know the basic of what is expected of him. If he is not able to deliver that, then yes, that's a breach of duty. The breach can either be of commission or omission, sometimes doing the wrong thing, or you know, failing to do something which is required of him. Now, damage suffered by the patients. So, example of such losses are, say, a loss of earning, whether due to enforced absence from work, of prevention or impairment of his ability to carry on his previous occupation, so that he is forced to take employment at a lower level of salary, or from loss of expectation of life and the consequent shortening of the earning period. Expenses, reduction in expectation of life apart from the financial aspect. So, you know, if you see from the patient's viewpoint, there are times when, you know, he has to miss his work for a long period of time, or he might lose his job, and then he suddenly takes up a job which is which gives him salary which is much lesser than before. So there are a lot of expenses. So patient, the kind of damage he suffers is again a matter of concern. Reduce enjoyment of life from any physical or mental consequence of the negligent act. So if the doctor sometimes acts in a negligent manner, the patient might suffer a lot. Examples would be loss of mobility or limb or sense, which would reduce his mobility or appreciation of his surroundings. In cases of women, some physical disability of disfigurement which might reduce the chances of marriage or ability to have further children might also be actionable. You know, recently there was this case where the doctor visited a cosmetic surgeon for something to be done on the face, and the face was, she had a marriage in the next 10 days, and the face suffered some, she had some allergic reaction due to which her marriage got cancelled. So I would not say it was negligence, but yes, the doctor should have informed the patient about the possible complications or the side effects that could have occurred. So it's always better inform the patient, take consent. The patient should also understand that doctor is not God. Doctor is not doing something which is going to harm the patient. So if it is happening, if it is his mistake, yes, that's a different chapter altogether. But if it is not his mistakes, then the patient should also understand that such things can happen in the course of treatment. Pain and suffering, whether physical or mental, may also be taken into account. Death may be actionable for the benefit of dependent relatives. In case of death, yes, the relatives, their friends, they can, we have seen cases of violence being reported to the hospitals in recent times, you know, when the patient has died and the relatives and they have come to the hospital and attacked the doctor. So nobody wants such things to happen. But yes, these are all the consequences suffered by the patients. Now, error of clinical judgment. There is widespread misapprehension amongst the public and even some lawyers that if anything goes wrong with medical treatment or diagnosis, then inevitably there must be negligence on the part of the doctor. So as we have seen in recent times, the media has, sorry to say that, but doctors have been projected in a very wrong manner, or the way everything is written about doctors and hospital. So there is anything that goes wrong with the patient, it says it's the mistake of the doctor. But that's not always the case. There is often a very fine line between the two situations and a gray area in which diversity of opinion may be found on poor view. However, a doctor is not legally liable for errors of judgment either in diagnosis or treatment. So you should always step into the other person's shoes. Why would a doctor do something which is going to harm the patient? Because ultimately it's his job, you know. If it is going to do something wrong, it is going to affect his practice. So nobody does this on purpose. But yes, there is a very fine line and between what is right and what is wrong. So the patient should always see from the doctor's viewpoint also. A doctor does not guarantee to provide the best possible care, but only care consistent with his professional status. As yet another famous judge said, doctors are not insured and cannot guarantee the perfect result except expected from an architect or a civil engineer. Yes, so this is very important, you know. An architect or a civil engineer, when they are working, you know, they are not dealing with humans. If an architect has to make a house or a building, you know, it's the structure, it's something to do with materials, it's something to do with machines, where, you know, he can predict the outcome because that is something which is predictable. But a human body is a big challenge, and it is impossible for any doctor to predict the result. Yes, 99%, 95% of the cases, the typical cases can be, the course of the treatment can be predicted, the prognosis can be predicted, but not in all the cases. Now let's come to what is known as contributory negligence. The patient does something on his own account to worsen the injury or retard its recovery. This is very commonly seen, you know, when the patient does not take the follow-up instructions. So the patient does something on his own and the injury worsens further. This may occur, for example, when the patient tampers with his dressings and induces infections, or removes a plaster cut or a bandage, or commonly ignores the instructions for follow-up treatments. In such cases, the damage recoverable in respect threshold shall be reduced to such an extent as the court thinks just and equitable, having regard to the claimant's share in the responsibility of the damage, in claiming that there was contributing negligence, that it existed. So, you know, it's not always the patients find it very easy to blame doctors, but they will never take the blame on themselves when they don't do the follow-up visits, when they don't follow the instructions given by the doctors, the dietary plan. You know, typically we see the doctors would advise some dietary plan, some exercise regimen, but the patients do not follow that, or they would open up their bandages, reinfection can occur. So it's always easy for the patients to blame the doctors, but they would never take the blame upon themselves that they have contributed to this. common forms of medical negligence. Medical negligence may assume a variety of forms. These include failure to attend. This is most important. Failure to attend, a failure of a general practitioner to respond to a request for attendance may form grounds for action of negligence, especially in relation to emergencies. You know, a doctor is called, say, maybe at 3 o'clock in the night, and if he fails to respond to an emergency, so he is failing to attend the patient. So this can come under negligence. The doctor is, say, out of the station or on a holiday. So what, in that case, what he can do is he can at least hand over the case to his colleagues, to his friends, so that, you know, it is professional ethics, you know, that the patient's welfare, patient's well-being is of utmost importance. So it is always better in such cases to refer the cases. But if he fails to attend, then yes, that's negligence. Amputation of the wrong limb or digit, this is very common. It has, we have read about it a lot in the past. Carelessness in hospital notes, so not recording things properly, errors in preoperative skin marking, failure to check notes are common causes for this misadventure. A similar mistake involves operating on the wrong patients altogether. Yes, again, our ecosystem is such that, you know, the number of beds are less, number of patients are more, doctors are overburdened with work, but that does not mean that just because they have so much of work that they do these kind of misadventures, you know, this is not permissible. Negligence in operation. Any surgical procedure may give rise to allegations of negligence, but orthopedics, obstetrics, surgery and gynecologists are very high risk specialties. One should understand that. Missed fractures, tight plaster casts and poor results from spinal procedures are common complaints in orthopedics. Damage to the newborn from anoxia or forceps procedures are of very common examples. A common error is operating on the wrong side and the operation is performed on an organ and another one is injured. So these are all the typical cases where which can be called as negligence. Retention of objects in operation site. Yes, a very famous case where, you know, a pair of scissors were left behind, a pair of cloth left behind in the intestine. Yes, they have happened. So where swab, packs, towels, instruments may be left behind in the abdomen after operation. And the responsibility remains with the surgeon or a theater sister as the actual task of maintaining a swab count. So, you know, then the blame game happens. The sister didn't do it. And the sister says, I was not supposed to. The doctor was the last attending one. So it's always better to avoid all these mishaps. But yes, these all form a part of negligence. Accident and emergency departments. In the medical legal sense, the accident and emergency department is the most dangerous parts of the hospital. Until recent years, it was commonly the practice for the least experienced doctors to deal with the most hazardous departments. So, you know, typically if you see the junior doctors were given duties at this because these cases used to come, say, maybe once in a while. Say in a hospital, typically in a hospital, an emergency or an accident would happen, say, maybe way less as compared to all the routine cases which generally come in. So if it's an inexperienced doctor, it's again a very tricky situation. Anesthesia is a potential source of allegation of negligence. Recently, we have seen 2-3 cases of anesthesia procedures given on dental chairs where the patients have died, children, the child has died. So anesthesia is the most common allegation, the potential source of allegation of negligence. So it is always advisable, like in case of dental, as we just discussed, you know, as far as possible, if it's a general anesthesia case, it's always better to do in a hospital setup because you never know if there is an emergency. Your clinical setup might not be up to date or I would say equipped enough to handle that emergency. The consent vigilance during anesthesia falls within the ambit duty of the anesthetist. It is the duty of the anesthetist to check the equipments, machines, prior to the operation and also if they are functioning correctly throughout the period when the patient was dependent on it. Since anesthesia is more of machine work, it is the duty of the anesthetist to check that all these things are working properly. An anesthetist administered chloroform in spite of the availability of another drug. The patient died and the anesthetist had to pay compensation. So this is gross negligence. Negligent exposure of patient to infection. The professionals cannot escape their liability in tort for negligent performance of duty even if he does the work free of cost for goodwill reasons. So again, I said, you know, this is a very, very tricky and a fine line. So even if a doctor is doing treatments of, for say free of cost, example, he is working in a charitable trust or in a camp and he is doing a treatment free of cost, but if he has acted in a negligent manner and the patient suffers, then yes, he is liable in that case. And I like this example, an iCamp was organized for extending expert ophthalmic surgeon services to the cataract patients in UP, and unfortunately the operated eye of patients were irreversibly damaged due to post-operative infection by the normal saline used at the time of surgery. So in such cases, even if it's a free camp, the doctor cannot escape from it, you know, it's if it's negligence, it's negligence. So PIL was filed before the Supreme Court, a public interest litigation, and the court directed the government to pay 12,500 rupees to each victim as a compensation for negligence. Now, negligent administrating of wrong medicine, very commonly seen. A medical practitioner is to be held liable even if a wrong medicine is administered by mistake. A simple lack of care of wound of care would amount to civil liability. So, but when a person knowingly acts at different to risk it, it will amount to recklessness and negligence or rashness of very high degree and would amount to criminal negligence. So, giving a wrong medicine to a patient is also negligent. In post-operative care, where is negligence seen is hospital authorities are expected to take reasonable care of the patient. So after the operation also, it becomes the duty of the hospital to take care of the patient. If the patient is suffering from an injury in the third and fourth fingers of his left hand, he was operated on the defendant's hospital by a surgeon. After the operation, the plaintiff's hand and forearm were bandaged to a splint and kept like that for 2 weeks. During this time, the patient complained of pain. However, the surgeon took no action apart from giving sedatives. When the bandages were removed, all the four fingers of the patient's hand were stiff and the hand was practically useless. So in that case, the hospital was liable for negligence on the part of the surgeon. So even if the operation is over, that does not mean that the hospital is not liable. The post-operative care is very, very important, especially when you see in surgeries, gynec cases, orthopedic cases, in all such high-risk cases, it's always better to give post-operative proper care. Therapeutic hazards, drugs with well-known potential dangers must also be handled with care. So all the drugs which are there, which you know are potentially hazardous, they have to be handled with care. For instance, it would be negligent for a doctor to give penicillin if the patient is allergic to penicillin, and if you are giving the same drug, then it's absolutely negligence. If he was aware of the possible and had not inquired. So when we talk of history taking, you know, it's always, this is one of the things that has to be filled in, the patient allergic to any medications. So the patient knows he is allergic to any medicines, it's always better to write it down. Also, the patient, if the doctor comes to know that the patient is allergic to a specific medicine, it has to be mentioned in those records. The patient should be given a list of medicines so that, you know, in future, whenever the patient visits a particular doctor, he should tell the doctor, I'm allergic to this particular medicine, so that all these potential mishaps can be avoided. Hospitals are liable for the negligence of its employees in India. So it's very, very clear, you know, hospital cannot escape its liability. Even if a doctor performs, yes, the doctor is held guilty, but it, the hospital at the same time is a party to it. It is a well-established settled law that hospital, whether it is government, public or private, when the services are provided in view of consideration, the hospital is liable for the negligence. Like the hospital cannot say that I have not done it, you know, the doctor has performed it, but it was done in the hospital, so the hospital becomes liable. But when a hospital is providing services free of charge, it is not held to be liable for negligence of employees. So this is again the situation where the hospital is providing, say in a charitable hospital, where the hospital is providing free of charge services, and if a surgeon has done something which is proved negligence, then the hospital cannot be held liable for that case. When the doctor fails in performing or commits lapse advertently, then they are open for both criminal and civil liability. So in such cases, then the ultimate blame would lie upon the doctor and he would be liable for both criminal and civil. So what's a criminal liability? It arises when it is proved that doctor committed or omitted that was grossly rash or negligent, which was direct or subsequent cause of patient death under section 304A. A doctor would be punishable with imprisonment for 2 years or fine or both. So that's typically a criminal liability, you know, when it is proved that the doctor has committed or omitted and it was grossly negligent. this is, though this is a bailable offense, the police cannot hold a doctor once the bail papers are furnished in a wrongfully confined confinement by a police station. The house officer can be charged under section 342 of the Indian Penal Code. So when is it a civil liability? It arises in case of medical services rendered on payment of fee. These come with a purview of section 73 and 74 of the Indian contract. In a suit by patient owners, the onus is on the patient to prove that the doctor was negligent. Even if the patient does not pay civil liability, can arise under the law of torts to all category of private or government. So even if the doctor is not charging the patient any fees, still, and if there is something that is proved negligence, then the doctor can be held in that case. Legal issues in relation to healthcare in India. Health legislation in India. In 1997, a workshop was organized by the Department of Forensic Medicine, AIIMS, and the World Health Organization. AIIMS is All India Institute of Medical Sciences. Health legislations are to monitor the overall health and the environment of any society, and therefore its knowledge and understanding to the medical experts engaged in healthcare is very, very necessary, not only to implement and to protect the health of the people, but also to safeguard its own interest. So, you know, to safeguard the own interest, it is very necessary that knowledge and understanding of the medical experts engaged in healthcare is there. Therefore, an additional category numbered as the 23rd category has been added. Example, the medical legal responsibility of the physicians in medical practice. Various health legislations are passed in Parliament in India in the last 5 years, covering the areas of health, manpower, disease control, family health, reproduction, mental health, food safety, control of toxic chemicals, smoking, alcohol consumption, marketing, manufacturing, safety of pharmaceutical and medical devices. Police health legislations are dealt as separate acts pertaining the health, environment, industry, chemicals, etc., in addition to the Indian Penal Code, CRPC, IEA, civil procedure codes in India. Now, what is the Indian Medical Council Act? This was the act which was passed in 1956. It is an act to provide for the reconstitution of the Medical Council of India and the maintenance of medical register for Indian and for matters connected therewith. It was enacted by the Parliament in the 7th year of the Republic of India as follows. This act may be called as the Indian Medical Council Act 1956. It extends to the whole of India. It shall come into force such as dates as the central government may appoint by notification in the official gazette appointed. What is the constitution and composition of this council? The central government shall cause to be constituted as a council constituting one of the following members. One member from each of the from each state, then a union territory, to be nominated by the central government in consultation with the state government concerned. This is important. One member from each university to be elected amongst the members of the medical faculty of the university by members of the senate of the university, or in the case the university has no senate, then by members of the court. Third, one member from each state in which a state medical registrar is maintained to be elected from amongst themselves by persons enrolled on such register who possess the medical qualification included in the first or the second schedule or in part second of the third schedule. And seven members to be elected from amongst themselves by persons enrolled for any of the state medical registrar who possess the medical qualifications included in the part one of the third schedule. Eight members to be nominated by the central government. The president and the vice president of the council shall be elected by the members of the council from amongst themselves. And no act done by the council shall be questioned on the grounds merely on the existence of any vacancy or any defect in the constitution of the council. So, you know, no act done by the council can be just questioned just because on the grounds that there existed a vacancy. The president and the vice president should be elected by the members of the council amongst themselves. A mode of election. An election under clause B, clause C or clause D of subsection 1 of section 3 shall be conducted by the central government in accordance with such rules as made by it in this behalf, and any rules so made may provide that pending the preparation of the Indian medical registration in accordance with the provision of this act, the member shall be referred to in clause D of subsection 1 of section 3 may be nominated by the central government instead of being elected as provided therein. if there is any dispute arises regarding the election of the council, it shall be referred to the central government, whose decision shall be binding and final. Restrictions or nominations and membership. No person shall be eligible for nomination under clause A of subsection 1 of section 3 unless he possesses any of the medical qualifications included in the first and second schedules, resides in the state medical registered, is maintained in the state, enrolled on the register, and no person may at the same time serve as a member in more than one capacity. Incorporation of the council. The council so constituted shall be a body corporate by the name of the Medical Council of India, having perpetual succession and a common seal, with the power to acquire and hold property both movable and immovable, and to contract, and shall by the same name sue and be sued. Thank you.